his former compound. Jonas fell into the deepest sleep he could remember, one that blissfully lacked any nightmares. But then it happened. As if grasped from one world and yanked into another, he found himself standing in the middle of a grassy field, facing a man in long, shimmering white robes, a man he recognized all too well. Timotheus wasn't old, or at least he didn't appear to be old. His face was no more lined than Jonas's brother Tomas's would have been at 22, had he lived. His eyes, though, betrayed his true age. They were ancient.
"Welcome, Jonas," Timotheus said.
Jonas glanced around, seeing nothing but the grassy field stretched out in all directions.
"I figured you were done with me."
"Not yet."
Jonas turned to meet Timotheus's gaze fully, refusing to be intimidated by this immortal.
"I defied your prophecy. Lucia is still alive."
"Yes, she is.
And she had a child.
A daughter named Lyssa,
whose eyes glow with violet light on occasion." Timotheus nodded at Jonas's shocked look.
"I have ways of knowing many things, so let's not waste time retreading what has already occurred. The child is of great interest to me, but she is not why I need to speak with you now."
Fresh resentment coursed through Jonas. These otherworldly immortals spent centuries watching mortals through the eyes of hawks, but provided little in the way of actual help. He preferred it when watchers were only myth and legend he could ignore at will, not an annoying reality. Jonas paced nervously back and forth. This didn't feel like a dream. In a dream, everything seemed hazy and hard to grasp onto. Here, he could feel the mossy ground beneath his feet, the warm sunlight on his face. He could smell the flowers that surrounded them as fragrant as those in his sister Felicia's small garden.
"Roses," he thought,
"but sweeter somehow. More like the sugar crisps he'd enjoyed as a rare treat as a young boy, made by a kind woman in his village." He shook his head to clear it of the distracting sensations all around him.
"Then you know the kindred are free," he said.
"Two of them, anyway.
And Cleo and Taryn, they're in trouble. Great trouble."
He paused to rub his forehead hard.
"Why did you let that happen?"
Timotheus turned his face away from Jonas's accusatory glare. There was nothing in the distance for him to focus on. The lush green field seemed to go on and on forever in all directions.
"Does Lucia have possession of all four crystal orbs?"
"Why should I tell you anything when you seem to know it all?"
"Tell me,"
Timotheus said, as harshly as he'd ever said anything before. Something lurched in Jonas's chest. Something strange and unpleasant that reminded him of Lucia's ability to draw the truth out of him whether he wished to speak it or not.
"She has three," he bit out. "Amber, Moonstone, and Obsidian. The Obsidian orb had a crack in it, I'm told, but it doesn't anymore."
"It healed itself,"
Timotheus said.
"I don't know. I would guess it did."
Timotheus's brows drew together.
"What about the aquamarine orb?"
Again, Jonas felt a strange compulsion to reply with the truth.
"Cleo has that one."
"She can touch it without great difficulty."
"No, she carries it with her in a pouch," Jonas replied.
Timotheus nodded, his expression contemplative.
"Very well."
The strange, magical grip on Jonas's throat eased.
"Do you have any idea how irritating it is to be lied to and manipulated?"
"Yes. Actually, I do."
Timotheus, his arms crossed over his chest, began to walk a slow circle around Jonas, peering at the rebel with narrowed eyes.
"If you know everything," Jonas said, "you'll know Lucia's in mourning for her brother.
If you want her to help you stop Kyan, you could tell us where Magnus is, and whether there's any chance he's still alive.
You care about someone you wanted dead not so long ago?
That was a trickier question than he'd like it to be. I care that Lucia is in pain. And Magnus, for all his faults, he could be useful in the coming war.
The war against the Kindred.
He nodded. Against the Kindred, against the Empress, against anything that comes our way in the future.
I'm not here for that.
Jonas hissed out a breath of frustration.
Then what are you here for?
Timotheus didn't speak for a moment. Jonas realized that, despite the immortal's eternal youth, he looked tired and drawn, as if he hadn't slept in weeks.
Do immortals even need sleep? He wondered. This is almost over, Timotheus finally said,
and Jonas could have sworn he heard pain edging his words.
What is almost over? My watch.
Timotheus sighed, and with his hands clasped behind his back, he began moving again through the long grass. He looked up at the sunless but bright blue sky.
I was created to watch over the Kindred. Watch over mortals. Watch over those of my own kind. I have failed in all regards. I inherited Eva's visions, and they've been no use to me other than to see 1,000 versions of what might be. And now it has come to this.
To what? Jonas prompted.
A small handful of allies that I've enlisted to foolishly fight against fate itself. I saw you in my visions, Jonas, years ago. I saw that you would be useful to me. And I've come to realize that you are one of the few mortals I can trust.
Why me? Jonas asked, stunned.
I'm nobody. I'm the son of a Pelsian wine seller. I stupidly joined the war against a good king and helped put Mitica into the hands of the King of Blood. I've led friends to their deaths because of my idiotic choices to rebel against that king. I've lost everything I've ever cared about. And now I have this strange magic inside me.
He rubbed his chest where the spiral mark had appeared only a month ago.
And it's useless to me. I can't properly channel it at will to help anyone or anything. Not even myself.
You think too much, Jonas Agalon.
Jonas let out a nervous snort of laughter.
No one's ever accused me of that before.
A small smile touched Timotheus's lips.
You are brave. You are strong. And you are worthy of this.
From the folds of his robe, Timotheus drew out an object. It was a golden dagger, beautiful, unlike anything Jonas had ever seen in his life. The blade was covered in etchings, symbols, some of which appeared to be the symbols for elemental magic. Something shimmered from the blade. Jonas couldn't see it exactly, but he could sense it. Magic. But not just any magic. Ancient magic. Timotheus placed the heavy golden hilt in his hand. Jonas inhaled sharply, as a cool shiver of that ancient magic traveled up his arm.
What is this? He managed to ask.
A dagger, Timotheus said simply.
I can see that much.
But what kind of dagger?
What does it do?
It can kill.
Jonas glared at the immortal.
Just speak plainly to me for once, would you?
Timotheus's smile grew, but his eyes remained deadly serious.
This dagger has been wielded by several immortals over millennia. It contains magic that can enslave and control minds and wills. It can kill. An immortal. It can absorb magic. And it can destroy magic.
destroy magic.
Jonas frowned, his gaze locked upon the golden blade. The sunlight caught the metal and cast a prism of colors down to the grassy ground.
Lucia said the kindred couldn't be destroyed. Even if I had the chance to get close enough to shove this into Kayan's chest, all I'd be doing is murdering Nick.
Timotheus's expression grew strained.
I can't tell you exactly what you need to do.
Frustration burned in Jonas's chest.
Why not? That's not how it works. My direct involvement beyond what I've already done is not allowed. I am a watcher. I watch. It's all I'm permitted to do. To say any more is literally impossible for me. But hear me, Jonas Agalon. Lucia is, and always will be, the key to all of this. Kayan still needs her.
Jonas shook his head.
Lucia won't help him. She's different now. She'll do anything to stop him.
Timotheus's jaw tensed, his gaze fixed upon the dagger.
This weapon can stop her as well. Even at her most powerful.
Jonas blinked, understanding all too well what the immortal meant.
I won't kill Lucia, he growled. I've seen her die, Jonas. I've seen a precise moment in the future with this very blade in her chest and you standing over her.
His expression shuddered.
I've said too much already. This is over. The remainder of my magic is nearly gone, and I have no more to spare on entering the dreams of mortals. You must go forth alone now. Wait, no!
Panic rose in Jonas's chest.
You need to tell me more. You can't stop now!
Timotheus glanced to the right of the colorful meadow, seemingly at nothing at all.
You're needed elsewhere.
Jonas frowned.
What? What are you...
The expansive field of green shattered, falling away like shards of glass. Jonas realized someone was shaking him awake. He opened his eyes to see Taryn Rhaenys staring down at him.
Jonas, wake up, he urged. What is it? Felix is going to be executed.
The fogginess of sleep left him in a rush.
When?
Now. Jonas sat up so quickly that a wave of dizziness hit him. He noticed something cold and heavy in his hand, and he looked down with shock to see that he held the very same golden dagger that Timotheus had given him in the dream. But how? He let go of it as if it had been covered in spiders. The weapon lay there on the blanket, shimmering in the meager light of the room.
Hurry!
Taryn barked as he pulled on a shirt. For a moment, Jonas's mind went completely blank, as if he couldn't make a decision or move or rationalize what had happened. But then he realized what Taryn had said. His friend was in danger. Nothing else mattered right now. Jonas grabbed the strange new dagger, thrust it into the empty holder on his belt, and joined Taryn as they left the small room the Empress had provided for them during their stay at the compound.
"Thought you hated Felix,"
Jonas said as they rushed toward the prison.
Only in the beginning. He's a friend now, just like you. How did you hear of this?
Taryn frowned deeply.
I heard voices. In the air. Guards discussing doing away with a difficult prisoner. They were loud enough to wake me.
Jonas had no reply to this. He knew the air kindred was inside Taryn now, just as the water kindred was within Cleo. But Taryn had barely spoken of it since Jonas's arrival. They arrived at a small, dusty clearing just outside the compound's prison area, just as guards dragged Felix out in chains. A small crowd of guards and servants had gathered to watch as Felix was forced to his knees, his head shoved down onto a chopping block. Jonas pushed through the crowd, just as the executioner raised his axe. Felix's gaze met his. The defeat in Felix's single eye said it all. Amara had won. They were too late. There was no time to yell or fight or try to stop this. Jonas could only watch in horror as the axe sliced downward and stopped only a whisper above Felix's flesh. The guard's muscles bulged as he tried to push down against an invisible barrier. Jonas shot a look at Taran to see that perspiration coated his forehead. His eyes glowed with white light. Spidery white lines appeared on his hands, wrapping around his wrists.
"You're doing this," Jonas managed.
I don't know how," Taran replied tightly.
The axe went flying, hitting the side of a building so hard that the blade buried itself fully into the stone surface. Then, the guard flew backward as if shoved by an invisible hand.
"Air magic!"
a nearby woman gasped. All those around her began to speak, to shout, and every gaze in the clearing turned to stare at Taran. Taran looked wide-eyed at the glowing spiral mark on his right hand. It was surrounded by white lines, spreading and curling around his skin.
"Don't just gawk at me,"
Taran said through clenched teeth.
"Go get him!"
Jonas did as Taran said, and ran up to the execution platform, cutting through Felix's ropes quickly with his new blade. He offered Felix's hand to stand, and Felix grasped it without hesitation.
"Twice now," Felix said to Jonas, his voice thick. "You've saved my arse twice."
"You can thank Taran for this one."
Jonas embraced his friend, slapping him on the back. The guards, who might have intervened at this point, all took a step backward as Taran approached. Jonas noted that Taran's face was pale, his deep tan completely gone. Dark circles, like bruises, had appeared beneath his eyes.
"Don't look at me like that," Taran said, wincing.
"I hate this."
"I don't," Felix replied quickly. "It's good to have a god on my side of things."
"I'm no god."
Still, when Taran glanced toward the dozens of onlookers, they all took a step backward, servants and guards alike.
"I can't stay here," Taran muttered.
"You're right," Jonas said.
This was no place for any of them.
He had to speak to Cleo, to Lucia.
He had to convince them to move on, away from the watch of the Empress. Amara wouldn't stop them. She feared them. He spotted the captain of the guard, Carlos, approaching them fearlessly, his sword drawn.
"We have no fight with you today," Jonas said, spreading his hands.
"But you will not execute my friend. Not now, not ever."
"The Empress commanded it," Carlos said.
Felix muttered something very dark under his breath about the commanding Empress, then louder.
"If the Empress wishes me dead, have her come out here and do it herself."
Jonas glared at him.
"Kindly shut up."
Felix glared back at Jonas.
"I hate her.
I know."
Jonas regarded Carlos again.
"You can see that we have power. We have strength. And we will not stand by and let you imprison our friends any longer.
We're leaving this place, and Prince Asha is coming with us."
Jonas had certainly gathered a strange group of friends over the last few months. Terrace had told him that Prince Asha hadn't betrayed them after all when he'd left their group in Basilia without a word. He'd gone to his sister's side to convince her to halt her evil ways. Clearly, Amara had ignored him. Prince Asher Cortis was every bit a rebel as Jonas was himself.
"I'm certain the Empress will have no issues with your departure," Carlos said, his eyes narrow and cruel. "But Prince Asher will not be joining you."
"Perhaps you didn't hear him," Felix said, his fists tight. "Go get him now, or my friend Taran is going to reduce this compound to a pile of rocks. Right, Taran?"
Jonas glanced at Taran, who also appeared ready to fight. His eyes still glowed.
"Right,"
Taran said. Jonas wondered for just a moment if Taran could actually control this godlike power within him that he'd just used to save Felix, or if he was bluffing.
"I will tell you again," Jonas said,
his attention fixed on the large armed guard.
Free Prince Ashokortis immediately.
Carlo shook his head.
An impossible request.
Why?
Because the prince,
Carlos began, his expression grim,
escaped from his cell late last night.
Chapter 7 Magnus, Palsea. For what felt like an eternity, Magnus scratched at the wood in the inky darkness of his minuscule prison. Blood dripped onto his face from his torn-up fingertips, but he continued until the pain became unbearable. He fought against unconsciousness until it claimed him. When he woke, his fingers had healed. Without the bloodstone, he would have been dead and broken and worthless. With it, he still had a chance. To save his father's life, Magnus's grandmother had literally cut this ring from the finger of an exiled watcher. He didn't know the bloodstone's origins. Frankly, he didn't care. All that mattered was that it existed, and somehow, at some time when he had it noticed, his father had slipped this invaluable ring into Magnus's pocket. But why would the man who'd tormented him his entire life, who'd literally tried to kill Magnus not so very long ago, do such a thing? Why would he give up such an incredible piece of magic?
"What game are you playing with me now, father?" he muttered.
Tormented by a thousand answers to that question, Magnus clawed at the lid of his coffin, aided by the rain-soaked earth that made the wood more pliable, weaker.
"Weak things are so very easy to break."
It was a harsh lesson from his father, one of many over Magnus's life. He tried to focus only on his seemingly insurmountable task, and on Lord Curtis. Magnus had no idea how many days had passed, and whether he still had time to stop Curtis from his horrific plans. The thought made him shake with anger, frustration, and fear. Cleo had to be smarter than to trust the former King's Liege. She wouldn't allow herself to be alone with him. "It didn't matter," another voice in his head observed. "Curtis can knock her out and drag her away somewhere no one would ever find her again." A cry of rage tore from his throat as he yanked a larger shard of wood from its place and mud poured through the hole in the lid, covering his face. He roared and pushed it away, but more came, like a cold, wet, demonic blanket meant to smother him. It filled his mouth, his throat. He choked on it, holding on to one single thought that gave him strength.
"Nothing can kill me with this ring on my finger."
He shoved, pushed, and dug at the mud and dirt shoveled on top of his unmarked grave. Slow. It was so painfully slow. But he did not give up. Darkness had become his entire world. Now, he kept his eyes squeezed shut to protect them from the mud. Inch by inch, he pressed upward, one handful at a time. Slowly. Slowly. Until finally, after a thrust of his fist, the sensation of cool air took him by surprise. He froze for a moment before stretching out his fingers to feel for any further barriers. But there were none. Despite the strength that had flowed through him after putting on the ring, he wanted to rest just for a few moments. He needed time to heal. But then Cleo's face appeared in his mind's eye.
"Giving up so easily?" she asked, raising an eyebrow. "How disappointing."
"Trying my best,"
he growled in reply, but only in his imagination.
"Try harder."
It sounded just like her. More cruel than kind in a moment of great importance. And it helped. Kindness had never, in Magnus's experience, brought anyone back from their own death. Only magic could do that. Muscles screaming with effort, he pushed further, finally freeing his other arm from the hungry earth. He grabbed hold of the muddy ground and pulled himself upward. It was as if the earth itself birthed him back into the real world. He lay there, his arm collapsed over his chest, and forced himself to take deep, choking breaths as his heart slammed against his ribcage. The stars were out, bright in the black sky. Stars. He could see stars after an eternity of utter darkness. They were the most beautiful things he'd ever seen in his entire life. When he laughed out loud at the thought, it sounded slightly hysterical. Magnus slid his dirt-encrusted fingers over the thick gold ring on his left hand.
"I don't understand this," he whispered. "But thank you, Father."
He wiped at his mud-covered face before he slowly, gingerly, pushed himself up to his feet on limbs that had very recently been shattered. He felt strong. Stronger than he should have, he knew. Magically strong. And ready to find and kill Curtis Cirillo. Or perhaps he was still buried. Moments from death, and this was only a vivid dream before the Darklands finally claimed him. For once in his life, Magnus Demora decided to be positive. Where was he? He looked around, seeing only a small clearing with nothing to mark his location or indicate how to get back to Amara's compound. He'd been unconscious when Curtis and his minions had brought him here. He could be anywhere. Without another glance at his former grave, Magnus chose a direction at random and began to walk. He needed food, drink, vengeance. But first and most importantly, he needed to know that Cleo was safe. He stumbled on a tangle of roots from a desiccated tree as he entered a wooded area.
"Bloody Palsia," he muttered with annoyance. "Utterly hateful during the day, even worse in the dead of night."
The moonlight shone down, lighting his path, now flanked by tall, leafless trees, a short distance from where he'd been buried. He twisted the ring on his finger, needing to feel its presence again, countless questions arising in his mind about where it came from and how its magic worked. What else could it do? Something caught his eye then. A campfire. He wasn't alone. He instinctively felt for his weapon, but of course he didn't have one. Even before Curtis had chained him up, Magnus had been Amara's prisoner. Barely breathing, he quietly drew closer to see who it was, envious of the warmth of the fire after being cold and damp for so long.
"Greetings, Prince Magnus. Come closer. I've been waiting for you."
He froze. The voice sounded familiar, but it wasn't Curtis like he'd half expected it to be. Magnus clenched his fists. If this was a threat, he was ready to kill whoever had issued it with his bare hands without a moment's hesitation. At the sight of bright red hair lit by the firelight, relief surged through him, and he relaxed his fists.
"Nick!"
Shame slammed into him as his eyes began to sting with tears.
"You're here. You're all right."
Nick smiled and stood up.
"I am. I thought Curtis had killed you."
"It seems we both survived, didn't we?" Magnus let out a hoarse laugh.
"Don't take this too personally, but I'm very happy to see you."
"The feeling is mutual."
Nick's gaze swept over him.
"You're covered in dirt."
Magnus looked down at himself, grimacing.
"I just dug myself out of my own damn grave."
Nick nodded thoughtfully.
"Olivia sensed you were underground."
Olivia, the girl who traveled with Jonas. Magnus didn't know her well at all, but knew she was rumored to be a witch.
"Where's Cleo?"
"At the compound last I checked." "Here, you look thirsty."
Nick offered him a flask.
"I know you're partial to pale sea and wine."
Magnus grasped the container and tipped it back. The wine was like life itself on his tongue, the purest pleasure in existence as it slid down his throat.
"Thank you. Thank you for this, for being here. Now, we have to get back to the compound."
He sent a look toward the forest surrounding them, but it was all in darkness beyond the firelight.
"Curtis means to hurt Cleo.
and I'm going to kill him before he does.
Nick took a seat across the campfire from Magnus, cocking his head.
That's right.
You don't know what happened, do you?
How could he act so nonchalant about a threat to his childhood friend? Something felt off about Nick. Incredibly off.
What do you mean?
Magnus asked, now more cautious.
The night you disappeared, your grandmother performed a ritual.
My grandmother?
Magnus blinked. The last time he'd seen her was just before his father had angrily sent her away.
Where is she now?
Your father killed her.
Nick's expression darkened.
Broke her neck before she was done.
And now everything is going wrong.
Magnus gaped at him.
What? What's he talking about? He killed her?
Nick grabbed a stick and jabbed at the fire with much more force than necessary.
Only the sorceress could have performed the ritual properly. I see that now. I was too impatient.
The wine had quickly worked to ease some of Magnus's stress, but it blurred his thoughts. Nothing Nick said made sense to him.
What nonsense are you speaking? Be clear. I need to know what happened, Nick.
Nick threw the stick to the side.
You keep calling me that. Yet it's not my name.
Magnus hissed out a breath of frustration.
Oh? And what would you prefer? Niccolo? Lord Niccolo, perhaps? You just told me my grandmother is dead at the hand of my father.
That shouldn't surprise you. Your father is a reckless murderer, just like you have the tendency to be.
Nick regarded him for a moment.
It's time to get to the point, I think.
There was something in his otherwise familiar brown eyes that Magnus didn't recognize. It was the look of a predator.
Cleo is in danger,
Magnus said more carefully now.
We need to get back to Amara's compound.
You're right. She is in danger. And I need you to give her a message for me.
Magnus's heart thudded as he studied Nick, trying to figure out why he was so strange tonight.
You're not coming with me?
Not quite yet.
What the hell is going on?
Only this.
Nick held his hand out, and a flame appeared in his palm.
Have you guessed yet? Or do you still want to call me Nick?
Magnus stared at the flame as if hypnotized. Then his gaze shot to Nick's eyes. They weren't brown like before. They were blue. And glowing.
It couldn't be. Cayenne,
he managed.
He nodded. Much better. Knowledge is power, they say. But I think fire is the only power that matters.
He stepped closer to Magnus.
Your little golden princess is the chosen vessel for the water kindred. But the ritual went awry thanks to your grandmother's weak magic and your father's stupid choice to end her life. You will tell Cleona that she needs to come with me and Olivia when we arrive, without a fight, without an argument.
Magnus grappled to make sense of all this. That Nick was Cayenne. That Cleo was in danger, and not only because of Curtis.
Go near her and die,
Magnus growled.
Resistant, aren't you?
The fire god blinked, a smile curling the corner of his stolen mouth.
I will brand you with my fire to help ease this along. Then you won't be able to resist any command I give you.
His entire fist lit with blue flames, the same blue as his eyes. Magnus had seen this blue fire before, at the road camp during the battle with the rebels. Bodies touched by this fire shattered like glass. Magnus stumbled backward as Cayenne reached for him, and he frantically eyed the darkness for a way of escape.
Why did you choose Nick?
Magnus asked, hoping to distract Cayenne somehow.
Wasn't there anyone better?
Kyan laughed. Nicolo has a soul of fire.
Because of his hair. More the colour of carrots thrown into a horse's trough than fire, if you ask me.
Outward appearances mean nothing. All mortals are partial to one element. Nicolo's is fire.
Kyan raised a red brow.
Just like you.
Never knew we had anything in common.
Magnus moved backward as Kyan reached for him.
Touch me, and you'll lose that hand.
Quite an empty threat from someone without a weapon.
When Kyan reached out again, Magnus grabbed his wrist, wrenching it backward and away from him. Kyan's fiery hand extinguished in an instant, and the fire kindred frowned.
How did you do that? He asked.
Do what? Magnus growled.
The blue glow in Kyan's eyes brightened.
Unhand me or die, he snapped. Happy to.
Magnus shoved Kyan as hard as he could. With fury flashing through his gaze, Kyan staggered backward and tripped over the campfire. Magnus didn't wait. He took the opportunity to turn and run into the forest, plunging into darkness immediately. He was certain that Kyan was on his heels, waiting to grab him, to burn him. He slammed into something solid, something, or someone, that grabbed a hold of his shoulders.
Magnus, it's me, Usher. I was watching you. You and Nick. Usher.
Magnus searched the Kreatian prince's familiar face, barely visible as the clouds parted enough to allow a sliver of moonlight.
We'll have to get out of here. That's not Nick.
I know.
How did you find me?
Asher grimaced.
I wasn't searching for you.
Magnus had so many questions, but there was no time for answers.
I have to find Cleo.
Asher pulled the hood of his cloak up over his head.
I'll take you back to the compound. Follow me.
Chapter 8. Nick. Pelsia. Nick remembered being at the bottom of a pit. Reunited with Cleo. Reunited with Asher. Trapped and unable to escape. But at least they were together. But a moment of hope for a future, any future, was quickly quashed when the incorporeal fire kindred had taken over his body, sending Nick's consciousness spiraling downward into a bottomless abyss. He could still see. He could still hear, but he couldn't think, couldn't process what had happened to him, or make any sense of what it meant. It was like being lost in an eternal dream. But when Magnus grabbed Kyan's wrist, something very strange had happened. Nick woke up. The first thing Nick clearly saw was Magnus, covered in dirt from head to toe, staring at him like he was a monster. The second thing he thought he saw was Prince Asher Cortis, barely visible in the shadows behind the Lemurian prince.
Asher, he wanted to call out, but he couldn't form the words.
Kyan still had control. Still, Nick sensed Kyan's confusion over the sudden jolt of cold, unfamiliar magic. So much so that the fire kindred didn't pursue Magnus or even notice Asher's presence. What had happened? Nick knew this much. Prince Asher had a great interest in magic. He had explored the world far beyond Kreatia and Mitica in search of any trace of magic. On a Kreatian ship, during the trip from Uranus to Lemeros, before the confrontation in the Temple of Valoria over the Water Kindred, Asher had told Nick about many treasures he'd sought, wishing to acquire, before he and his sister had set their sights upon the kindred.
There is an amulet said to allow one the ability to speak with cats, the prince told him one day during a brief visit, his lightly accented voice like honeyed wine.
Nick, the courtesan's prisoner at the time, hadn't been entirely swayed by the prince's palpable charm, but he could never resist a good story.
What kind of cats? House cats? Wild cats?
I would imagine both.
Why only cats? Why not dogs, or ice wolves, or warlogs even? Asher frowned.
What in the world is a warlog?
It's like a rabbit... rat... thing, but not a rabbit or a rat. They're quite tasty with the right sauce, actually.
A rabbit-rat thing,
Asher repeated slowly. Exactly.
Why would you wish to communicate with it if you're going to eat it?
I didn't say I wanted to communicate with it. I was just trying to clarify... He sighed. Ah, forget it.
No, no. Please continue explaining this to me. The logic of Nicolò Cassian is fascinating.
Asher regarded him in the shadows of Nick's small locked cabin, where Amara believed him to be unconscious or restrained.
Would you tell this warlog that you meant to eat it? Or would you just ask it how its day has been?
Well, Nick considered this carefully. If I could communicate with it, I wouldn't want to eat it. So, yes, I suppose I would like to know how its day had been.
Then he scowled at Asher, his cheeks growing hot.
Are you laughing at me? I'm amusing to you, am I?
Asher's smile only grew. Endlessly so.
The point was, Asher knew magic. And it wasn't until he'd been present in the forest beyond the campfire that Nick could think as clearly as this, even if it was only to remember a trivial conversation with the prince. Asher had done something to help Nick. Some spell, perhaps. Nick wasn't sure. And neither was Kyan. The fire kindred left the campfire and returned to the cottage where he'd been staying since the failed ritual. Olivia waited for him there. She sat outside on the ground by the door, her hands entwined in a fresh growth of weeds that would be green and lively in the daylight. Beneath the meager moonlight, they looked unpleasantly like the grip of a gigantic black spider. The Earth Kindred had spent the last 2 days surrounding their temporary home, a meager stone cottage, with lush greenery. Kyan eyed it with distaste.
You'll draw attention to us with all of this fresh life. Pelsea is a wasteland.
Not for long. I will restore it all to how it was long ago.
She looked up at him, unable to mask the cold look in her gaze before he saw it.
I couldn't restore them.
Nick knew she meant the former owners of this cottage, an elderly couple that had resisted giving up their home. Their corpses lay close enough that the scent of burned flesh still lingered in the cool night air.
You don't have that particular power, dear sister.
This came out more harshly than Kyan had intended.
Earth magic requires a spark of life on which to grasp hold.
Oh, much gratitude for explaining that to me, Kyan. I wouldn't know such a thing, would I?
The cutting manner in which she said this almost made him wince.
Apologies. All these mortals will be gone soon enough anyway. We'll have a fresh canvas on which to start anew.
Olivia stood up and brushed her hands on the front of her dress.
Did you find Prince Magnus?
No,
Kyan lied.
It would have been convenient to have him enslaved to me, but it doesn't matter.
Fine.
The Earth Kindred's face twisted with annoyance, distorting Olivia's immortally beautiful features.
Then you need to set your sights on finding the sorceress and wooing her back to our side. We can't finish this without her.
Kyan summoned patience.
I know.
It wasn't as if Nick could hear the Fire Kindred's thoughts, but he could clearly sense them. Lucia was vital to them, more so than Kyan had ever believed. The fact that he had to go to her, this mere girl who had destroyed his former shell, to beg for her help. Kyan would rather burn the world right now and be done with it all. But he couldn't. He desperately needed to be reunited with the others, water and air, Cleo and Taryn. Panic coursed through Nick at the thought that Cleo was in terrible danger, and he couldn't do a damn thing to stop it. He had to try to gain control. If he could think, he wasn't gone. He wasn't dead.
Focus, he told himself. He focused on his hand, his right hand. He concentrated on trying to move it, something that had once been an easy and totally unconscious decision. He tried to move it, to raise it up ever so slightly, but not enough for Kayan to notice. He failed to move his hand, but he did move his little finger, ever so slightly. Not much, but it's a start, he thought grimly. He's still waiting for you, Olivia said as she went to the door of the cottage and opened it. And asking so many questions, I decided I needed the silence of outside. Kayan followed her into the cottage, sweeping his gaze across the meager home. He nodded at the hearth, and the fire lit within it. Then he shifted his gaze to the young man cowering in the corner. They'd found him wandering nearby with two of his friends. Kayan had burned the friends into oblivion immediately, but thought this one, Lord Curtis Cirillo, might be useful to him.
"I don't know why you're doing this, Niccolo," Curtis stuttered. "But my father is a great and powerful man. He will pay you as much gold as you want for you to release me unharmed."
Kayan just stared at him, finally allowing himself to smile. He loved mortals the most when they begged. "My name is Kayan." He lit his hand up with flames, enjoying the look of terror that entered Curtis's wild gaze. Nick, however, felt an odd jerk of sympathy for Curtis, even though he thoroughly despised the former King's Liege. A swift death would be so much kinder than what Kayan had in mind. Kayan cocked his head.
"Let's begin, shall we?"
Chapter 9. Lucia. Palsia. Magnus would have thought her mad to stay here at Amara's guest a moment longer than necessary. And so Lucia embraced the thought of leaving this strange, dusty compound. It was her birthplace, but it wasn't her home. Lemeros was her home. She craved her chambers at the palace, and knew several trustworthy nursemaids there who could help her with Lyssa. However, they were not headed for Lemeros. Her father wanted to go to the Iranian palace, where he could speak with Lord Gareth Cirillo. Gareth had remained Grand King's Liege during the king's lengthy absence. Through Lord Gareth, the king wanted to find his son, Curtis, and Lucia wanted to help him. The evening before they were set to leave for the Iranian palace, Lucia searched the compound for Jonas, finding him sharpening his sword by his temporary quarters.
you coming with us? She asked. Or are you staying in Palsia?
He looked up from his work, as if surprised to see her.
Should I come with you?
Lucia had been forced to spend time with Jonas when he'd been tasked to return her to her father and brother. But now, after all this time together, the thought of parting from the rebel felt oddly painful. But she certainly wasn't going to admit that out loud.
"Cleo needs you," she'd said instead.
Jonas's brows raised.
"She said that?" "When Kayan returns, she will need all the help she can get. And I know Taryn has chosen to stay with her until everything is resolved."
His expression grew thoughtful.
"You make it sound like a minor inconvenience with a simple solution."
Hardly. Lucia needed time herself to strengthen her magic, to figure out how best to trap the Fire Kindred, and now the Earth Kindred as well, in their crystal prisons.
"I know it isn't," she allowed.
Jonas studied her.
"For what it's worth, I'd already decided to come with you to Aranus. I feel a great need to keep a close eye on you, Princess. Both you and Lyssa."
She searched his face, looking for any sign of deception, but found nothing but sincerity. Jonas Agalon was, quite possibly, the most honest and forthright person she'd ever known in her life. She'd come to value him. And the thought that she wouldn't have to bid him farewell
eased something unnameable within her. And so they left the royal compound. Lucia and Lyssa, her father, Cleo, Jonas, Taryn, Felix, an attendant named Nerissa, and a guard by the name of Enzo. They began their 5-day journey south with the Empress's full permission, taking a ship from Trader's Harbor to the Iranian city of gold. Lucia didn't speak to Cleo. The other princess had gone into seclusion since learning of Magnus's death.
She loved him,
Lucia realized without anyone confirming it for her in as many words. This thought made her hate the princess just a little less. The waters along the channel from King's Harbor to the palace city were a blue-green that reminded Lucia of the aquamarine orb Cleo kept with her in a velvet drawstring pouch. A perfect match for the princess's eyes. Lucia would rather have that orb safely in her possession, along with the other three, but she hadn't yet made any demands. To think that Cleo had the power of a goddess within her. Part of her felt jealous. The other part felt sympathy. As Lucia watched the banks of the wide river pass from the deck of the ship, she twisted her amethyst ring, deep in thought. The ring protected her from her magic, once erratic and nearly impossible to control. It had protected her from Kyan when he'd taken his monstrous form, something she dreamed about most nights, and not only during the dream that Jonas had witnessed. Kyan had wanted to kill her, and he would have succeeded had it not been for the mysterious magic within the ring. A ring that Cleo had given to her of her own free will. It was the greatest treasure, apart from Lyssa, that belonged to Lucia. She prayed that it might help her defeat Kyan when the time came. And when the time came, she prayed that her magic would also be there without fail or doubt. The City of Gold appeared in the distance, a glittering and spectacular sight under the sun, surrounded by blue water and seemingly endless rolling hills of greenery. Lucia longed for a different sight, that of an obsidian black castle in the center of stark white perfection. Home. Would she ever see home again? Perhaps it would remind her far too much of Magnus, her brother and her best friend. He was yet another person she had betrayed, and now it broke her heart to know she would never have the chance to make amends for this. Lucia, with Lyssa in her arms, disembarked from the ship, and as they walked along the lengthy wooden dock to reach a series of waiting carriages that would take them the remaining short distance to the palace, Lucia shielded her eyes from the sunlight to look up at the shining City of Gold with its glittering wall. The towering spires of the palace were in the direct center of the guarded city. Then her view of the city was replaced by the face of Cleona Belos. Her skin was pale, and the rims of her eyes red, but she held her chin high.
Yes, Lucia prompted when she didn't immediately speak. The nursemaid who looked after my sister and me is still at the palace, Cleo said. She was wonderful. Kind and sweet, but not weak in any way. I would highly recommend her to look after your daughter.
Lucia looked down at the face of her baby for a moment. Lyssa blinked, her otherworldly purple eyes shifting in an instant to a more normal blue. A shiver went down Lucia's spine. She didn't know why that happened or what it meant.
Much gratitude for the suggestion, she replied.
Cleo nodded and went to join her attendant as they entered the palace. Once inside, Lucia asked for Cleo's nursemaid and found her willing and able to attend to Lyssa. She held back any threat she was tempted to make about her daughter's well-being. After kissing Lyssa's forehead in the cradle, the nursemaid had swiftly readied. Lucia went to join her father for their audience with Lord Gareth. The King's Liege wished to meet in the throne room, which had once held golden Iranian decorations and embroidered banners emblazoned with the image of the goddess Cleona and the Belos family crest, but which now held only a few small reminders of the time when King Corvin had ruled.
her gaze lifted to the familiar walls, the stained glass windows. An expanse of marble floor and columns lined the hall, leading to the dais and golden throne. Lord Gareth waited for them in the center of the room. His beard had grown thicker and bushier, and more streaked with white than the last time Lucia had seen him. He held out his hands to the king and Lucia.
"Welcome, my dear friends. I hope your trip here was pleasant."
The sound of his reedy voice, reminiscent of his hateful son's, made Lucia's blood boil.
"As pleasant as a trip aboard a Prashian ship could be," the king replied.
Lord Gareth laughed.
"The Empress hasn't kept any Lemurian vessels for such an occasion." "It seems she's had most of them burned." "And now we are all Kratians, as it were. Let's hope only for brighter days ahead, yes?"
His gaze swept over Lucia.
"You've grown up to be an incredibly beautiful young woman, my dear."
She did not meet the compliment with a smile, or a nod, or a blush of her cheeks, as would have been expected of her in the past.
"Where is your son, Lord Gareth?"
she said instead. Lord Gareth's pleasant expression dropped.
"Curtis? I haven't seen him since I left Lemeros at your father's command to come here." "But you've exchanged many messages with him," the king said. "Even after he became one of Amara's most loyal minions."
The lord's expression became more guarded.
"Your Majesty, the occupation has been difficult for us all, but we're trying as well as we can to adjust to the choices you've made for Mitika's future. If anything my son has done seems disloyal, I can assure you he has only tried to fit in with the new regime as best he can. News reaches me only today that many of the Empress's soldiers have been called back to Kratia. I wonder if this means that the occupation will slowly and steadily be scaled back to next to nothing."
"That is very possible," the king allowed. "I think Amara has lost her interest in Mitika."
"Good," Lord Gareth nodded. "Which means we can all get back to business as usual." "Did Curtis tell you that he recently lost his hand?"
the king asked casually, moving toward the stairs leading to the throne. He glanced over his shoulder.
"That my son sliced it from his wrist."
Lord Gareth blinked.
"Why, yes, he did mention that. He also mentioned that it was as a result of your orders, Your Majesty, that he came upon such an unfortunate injury. You asked him to deliver Princess Cleona to you, and it seems that Prince Magnus disagreed."
The king finished for him when he trailed off.
"Rather strongly, yes, he did. My son and I have not seen many issues quite in the same way. Princess Cleona is most definitely one of them."
Lucia watched on, suddenly fascinated. She hadn't heard any of this before now.
"Magnus chopped off Curtis's hand to save Cleo,"
she said aloud, bemused.
"It was an impulsive choice,"
Lord Gareth replied, a thread of distaste in his tone.
"But it cannot be undone, so let's put it behind us, shall we?" "Have you heard from Curtis recently?"
the king said as he sat down upon the magnificent gilded throne and leaned back, gazing down at Lord Gareth at the bottom of the stairs.
"Not in more than a week." "So you don't know what he's done now?"
Lord Gareth frowned deeply, his quizzical gaze moving to Lucia for a moment.
"I do not." "Not even a rumor?"
Lucia asked.
"I have heard many rumors,"
Lord Gareth replied thinly.
"But mostly about you, Princess, not my son."
"Oh? Such as?"
"I don't think there's any need to indulge the whispers of peasants."
She hated this man. had always hated the simpering manner he used around the king, pretending to be friendly and helpful when she saw the deviousness behind every word he uttered and every move he made.